the region from here.
Now I can hear you.
In progress.
Okay, go ahead, Patuk.
I'll go ahead and get started. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the 1:30 session on INCS, looking back 50 years later. I'm going to be your moderator this afternoon. My name is Patuk Glenn. I'm from Utqiagvik. My mom and dad are Richard and Arlene Glenn, and I have the honor to introduce Willie Hensley and Oliver Levitt, who have been in many ways my heroes as someone that has studied history and self-determination, and I'm lucky enough to know them on a personal level. A little bit about me before we get started. I am on the Alaska Historical Society Board of Directors. I work for the Arctic Slope Community Foundation as executive director. I've spent time working for our regional corporation, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, as community economic development project manager. I worked at our museum, local museum, History, Language, and Culture for Inupiat people, where I got to know all of this stuff intimately, studying our history and understanding a little bit more in depth about our self-determination. And that's when I truly begin to realize how big of rock stars that Oliver and Willie were. And we're so thankful that they're still here with us today to tell their story. So now a little bit about Oliver. And he is actually Dr. Oliver Levitt. He's been given the title honorary doctorate from University of Alaska Fairbanks. He has a whaling crew in Barrow. He's got many children and grandchildren. And he's had his whole career started, you know, he came back from the Vietnam War and he came back to his community and they asked him to lead for him. And he was working when he first came back for Arctic Slope Native Association. He was their treasurer. And so he was in those initial days of the Alaska Federation of Natives, which helped lead into the original agreement for ANCSA. And he, even after that, he was the AFN board member. He was one of many. From 1971 to 1999, he was the chair from 1985 to 1986. And then he even served as president of the North Slope Borough Assembly. He served on our ASRC Board of Directors for many years, I think 20 plus years, maybe longer. He was the VP of External Affairs. I mean, he's been able to negotiate many things for our region that we all should be thankful for today. Now we also have Willie. You know, Willie Hensley is from right next door. He's from the Nana region, from Kotzebue. And he's currently a UAA professor. He worked many years in federal relationships for Nana. He also worked as for the state as the Commissioner of Commerce. He's had 20 plus years in Nana. And he was an original founder of AFN. And he's got six kids and 12 grandkids. And so both of these guys I've read about in books, but I've been very lucky enough to know on a personal level, call them Adada, or call it even text. Now we're lucky enough, we got cell phone, we can text and connect sometimes. And they were gracious enough to allow me to bother them enough to speak to you guys today. And I know that I may be missing some things from their introduction. I would like for them to kind of introduce themselves a little bit and talk a little bit more about who they are and their involvement was what we now have today as the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and we're 50 years later. So if maybe we could start with you, Oliver, talk a little bit about who you are and a little bit about those initial days, and then we'll let Willie have a chance to talk a little bit about who he is. And then I want to make sure I play that that original audio of Nixon announcing that historic landmark decision that made ANCSA, because I think it's going to be really important for everybody that are listening to know more about how it was at that time, who you guys were at that time, and sort of the events that led to everything. That will be really cool to hear about. So I'm going to turn it over to you. I'm going to go on mute, Oliver.
Well, thank you, Patuk. That was kind of you to introduce us. Both Willie and I started with humble beginnings. We didn't know much. We had to go back to D.C. to find out what was going on, what was being said about us. There was a lot of proposals, and some of them weren't any good, and we knew that. And we still had to go and fend for ourselves about who we are, what we do, and why we believed in it so much. And I know that Willie is a good historian. And I love listening to him talk about himself, his own stories. And I suppose we all have our own stories, but Willis in particular is very good. And so without much further ado, I'd rather just turn it over to Willie to listen to him talk about himself and what he did back then. Rar?
No. I want to hear your story, Oliver, because I find yours more interesting because you know more stories of your part of the world than anybody I've talked to. Because I think what is important is to try to give the listeners some context of how life was and the monumental challenges that you had to face as well as the rest of us in terms of change and actually comprehension of what the heck was going on. I just have this image of you. You've told me about and maybe when we were out whaling or something about, you know, I was a wood chopper too, you know, as a kid. I mean, we all had to do something. But I just have this image of you and your dog team out there going along the shoreline in the dead of winter, trying to see if there was a piece of wood sticking up so that you can stay warm at home. I mean, you talk about humble beginnings. I mean, that's pretty much a story we've shared, I think. And I think people should hear that part, Oliver, of your life. Because people don't know.
Another time, maybe.
we can get more into depth on that. And I do want all of the conference participants to realize that back in that time, man, in order to keep warm, you had to go get driftwood. When these guys were young men or children, they would wake up and there was a pail of water and it was frozen. These guys, they grew up in a different time than us. And it is probably even way different than what Emo and Sam Keto, because they're in the South in some ways, different aspect. These two guys, they grew up in the North, and I mean, right now we have Facebook, right? We have all these VHF and everything. In those days, the communication, what we had Tundra Times, and we're lucky that there was Mount Edgecombe and these things to connect them all together. But they were awesome in what they did and how they did it and what little that they had to do it with. I do want to maybe what... Willie Oliver, would you guys mind if I played the video with Nixon's?
Sure.
Okay, let me share my screen. Okay, let me see. And then let me make sure my audio is shared. Okay, good. So just to give you guys listening a little bit more background information. This video was taken at one of the first AFNs, but this was, I mean, they had multiple meetings, Alaska Federation of Natives. This meeting was right before they found out that Nixon was going to announce the historic settlement deal. And I feel like this is such an important piece of history because you look around the room, you might see some familiar faces. The first person speaking is Joe Opikson. That was a leader of our region. And he proposed some pretty radical things. The original video, I would encourage you to watch it. We didn't always get along as all the regions of the state. However, we were able to get along long enough to come to this consensus. And, you know, in this year, I believe 1871, they were able to get Nixon to approve something, which it was no small feat. We can listen to this, but I would love to hear more from Oliver and Willie about what it took to get there. What was the time like? What was the feeling? What was all of this about? And what did you guys have to do to fight for even just getting this? So I'll play it and then we can talk.
Make no mistakes of it. We, the Alaska Natives, are being paid this so-called settlement for just one reason. Because we have legal rights.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, a milestone in Alaska history, and to bring our government deals with Native and Indian peoples. So the institutions of government are with fountains. And we follow this will. My cousin Magnus and I were in close consultation with your president, Mark. I ably and vigorously represented you in the process. My congratulations go also to Senator Fred Stevens, to Wally Hickel, and to those of both parties.
So my apologies. The audio was a little bit kind of rough. I've been spending all morning trying to edit that audio to reduce the background noise. But I think that, I mean, just watching that, I know that, I don't know if you, Willie, or Oliver were there at that time, but I imagine you may have heard it or you may have heard about it. What were your guys' feelings at the time that this was taking place?
I was there. You know, maybe before getting into that particular incident, as important as it was, Karen Brewster and others were wanting to know sort of what the conditions were like back then. I'm not sure if she was talking about political conditions or social economic conditions, but I would say that, you know, the 40s and 50s in the years that I was growing up, you know, it was, we were still living off the land primarily. In fact, I think our family was probably one of the last ones that actually lived in three different sod homes about 10 or 12 miles from Kotzebue. They were warm, in contrast to the tar paper shack we had in Kotzebue that didn't have enough insulation and had only one pane of window. But the reality was that we were pretty much staying alive like a lot of our people had done for millennia, really. We were primarily living off the same fish and birds and caribou and seals and belugas and whole varieties of fish and ducks and geese and plants that our people had survived on. And so, you know, we could still go to the sod house, the remains of the last sod house I lived in as a boy. When you talk about humble beginnings, I mean, you know, we weren't collectors of stuff back in those days. We just carried enough stuff that we could move around and get by on, because, you know, you had to carry it yourself or get it, put it on your dog team. I mean, in those days, there was absolutely no question in my own mind and then those of our people that this was our land. This had been our land for millennia, thousands of years. People were very, very intimate with the land. You know, I slept in the land, under the land, you know. And so those early impressions stayed with me my whole life. I mean, every day, really. And so we never in remotely thought that we would be having to fight for that land, you know, in the modern era, because it was simply unthinkable that this wasn't our land, okay? Of course, the way I look at it, I'd like to actually thank the commission for actually conducting this this series, because you know, maybe they're making up for lost time, but when I look back at the historical commission activities, their annual meetings, it was all about the pioneers, right? All about the native. We were not in the picture, and I'm not saying it was wrong. It was just their world that they were familiar with. They weren't involved and familiar with our world, the thousands of years of history, the stories, the art, the music, the knowledge. That wasn't their thing. We never understood colonialism, never even used the word. Even as we were fighting for our land, I didn't have the slightest sort of idea of what was involved in that notion. But as time has gone on, I have a better sense of what was taking place. And the reality is, you know, from, you know, 1491 on, I mean, Europe was claiming these lands for themselves with the blessing of the guy on high, you know, against those heathens, those poor heathens. And those are powerful concepts in history, because if you were a heathen, they could do anything day darn well with you, not only with your life, but with your land and your resources. And enslavement was acceptable. And so that was sort of the world we eventually came crosswise with when it comes to our land. Because that so-called notion of discovery, they figured, gave them the right to take it, right? And that was their legal system. Well, we didn't know all of that, you know? And anyway, oddly enough, when you brought up Richard Nixon, I mean, there he is right here. You know, Tricky Dick, they called him, but as far as I'm concerned, he's a hero. And, you know, he's the fellow who created self-determination. And in our case, probably... to the max, right? In terms of our own control of our own funds and our resources, right? But oddly enough, you know, he only knew one Indian, as far as I know. And that Indian was Wallace Newman, who was from the La Jolla Band of Mission Indians, who was a coach when he went to Whittier College and played football. And he had so much respect for Coach Newman. I heard the story, I don't know if it's true, that when he became president, he called Coach Newman, the Indian, and said, well, if you ever need anything, give me a call. Well, Coach Newman said, just take care of the Indians, is what his request was. Well, oddly enough, Nixon came from Whittier, California, which is where the church came from. The Friends Church came from Whittier, California, to Kotzebue in 1897 and sort of began to colonize us. Right? Anyway, I thought that's an interesting bit of history. But the truth of the matter is we were not knowledgeable about the Russian era history or the American practices with respect to the lower 48 Indians when we initially got into this. And we had, there were some real drawbacks to our situation, as Emo was mentioning in the beginning. First of all, we didn't have any statewide organization initially. We didn't have any lawyers initially. We didn't have any money. We didn't have any time, really. You have to remember that all this took place in just a 5-year period, really, between 66 and 71, in terms of the real politics of it. And so we were actually fighting with sort of two hands tied behind our back. We didn't know, for instance, I mean, when I look back, and thank God for the University of Alaska, I've had a chance to sit and think and read. If we had known that there were less than 800 Russians in Alaska at any one time, that to me, that was powerful, because how could they have even remotely had control of this vast space that's damn near, you know, continent size, right? And so there were things like that we didn't know.
Willie, I think this is a good time. I hate to interrupt my elders, but I feel like it's a good time to just say something really quickly. You know, you did bring up the Alaska Historical Society, and you talked a little bit about where does history begin in Alaska, right? Is it Russian occupation? Because ANCSA, the whole thing that had resulted from ANCSA was because Russia sold Alaska to the United States, right? And then the United States realized that we had all these resources here, specifically in the north, in the far north.
Well,
and so that it's kind of like a pathway for what you guys ended up, you know, think about it. You guys were like young men in the summer of love.
Let's clarify one thing. The Russians didn't have much to sell because their area of control was the Aleutians, Kodiak, portions of the Gulf. They got wiped out of Yakutat, never came back. They actually got wiped out at Sitka, but came back 2 years later. So in so far as having control of Alaska, they did not. And so what they sold was, you know, the remnants of the Russian American Company properties. And the only other thing that they had, which was this notion of discovery, right? If you were a Christian nation and you came upon an area that no other European country had come upon, that was sort of yours, right? But they did not, they never extinguished the underlying Aboriginal title, right? Which is something that in this country is recognized. The sovereign has the responsibility to either recognize it or not recognize it, right?
Yes.
Basically what the Russians sold was the right for the United States to negotiate with the proper owners, right? Which basically was ignored for 100 years. Okay. So that, I thought I'd just clarify that.
Thank you so much. I think that's very important to note, because I know that the Alaska Historical Society has focused on a lot of the colonizer successes. And we do have a lot of our own historical wins that we have had. And the history books need to be rewritten, and that our stories need to be more involved. And I know that both of you guys are going to go down into history for the heavy lifting that you guys have done. And I appreciate you and all of the work that you've done, Willie, in history, and even Oliver. And I mean, it's not even just the work that you've done in documenting it, but all the work that both of you guys have done in fighting for it. And that's what I'm most curious about now is, tell us about how it was like in the 60s, in the 70s, in that day and age, because all like young people like me, well, I'm 37, but I just see black and white images, you know, I just see black and white images, and I can only imagine what it was like during those days. It must have been wild times, fast times.
If I may, one of the things we did not have at that time was the telephone system. If you wanted to talk to someone from Wainwright, you had to call into their city office and then ask people to go around to see if they'd run into this person. And sometimes they call back. Other times they didn't. What Willie's talking is the news that we created, but we had no way of putting it out there. And it was very, very difficult to spread the news when you went and talked to people and have town meetings. You depended on the passage of the knowledge onto another and getting them to understand what is it we're talking about. And it was very difficult. You watch people cry. You watch people in tears, wishing they had some way of communicating to even to the next town. So it was not easy at times to get the word across. And many times, like what we did, but I know the very important thing that one of our elders used was parables. People learn about the Bible and they passed it on. So they learned to use parables as a way, as an example, to pass on the knowledge that we gained. And that's how we passed on to what we did to our villages throughout our region. And it was not easy. I mean, there was a lot of people that fought you and said, you guys, hey, whoa, whoa, whoa. You say, hey, what do you mean, you guys? Come on. How would you pass the knowledge that we have now on to the others? And it was just common sense, and because people had heard about the Bible and the teachings and passing on knowledge that way. Eddie Hobson, one of the great elders that we had, he was very in passing on knowledge by using parables. That's who I learned it from. But I didn't mean to go.
And your internet's starting to get a little bit shoddy.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe turn off the video camera for Oliver, since your internet's kind of jumpy, and that would save bandwidth.
And then And then what I do is I sock my kids and I tell them, get off the internet. No one's allowed on internet when I'm in Zoom.
Well, the connection in Utqiagvik, I'm sure, is sketchy.
It's so, like that, yeah. So
we'll maybe try that and see if that's better.
That might help so we could hear your audio a little bit less jumpy. Now, I know that we had a pre-meeting and we talked about some questions, but I want to make sure that we really capture what it was like and what it felt like, because I think for some of our viewers, it's hard to imagine and encompass. Like, Willie, you were in college, right, during this time, and Oliver came back from the Vietnam War, and you guys have become the professionals and the leaders in this. But it was, some people may say it was like a ragtag team that came from very many different backgrounds, but all knew how to live off the land. That was the common thing, right? That you guys may have been trained in various different fields or specialties, but you guys all ended up having to become, external affairs professionals overnight, political leaders overnight. How was that?
I think my mute is off. Thank you. You're correct. We are sort of starting from ground zero. We didn't have any legal or historical knowledge to speak of. We didn't understand the notion of colonialism, that there's countries out there that want what you have, and they'll take it one way or the other. And had been happening, of course, throughout human history, I guess. Anyway, I didn't know anything until I wrote this little thingamajig here. Can't see it. Can you see it? Mm-hmm. What rights to land of the Alaska Natives, the primary question? Well, he took Charlie Edwardson from Barrow. Actually, was more knowledgeable initially. He learned about me from Brenda Itta, because I was going to school in D.C. at George Washington, and she was working for Senator Greening after she went to Haskell Institute, where the BIA usually sent Indians to learn a skill. Anyway, she told Ituk about me. At that point, Ituk had learned about land issues from when he was in high school down in Edgecombe. And I think he learned from William Paul, who was a First Native attorney. At that time, Ituk was helping organize ASNA. And I've got some letters from him, handwritten, misspelled words, yellow line paper. Anyway, they were trying to decide how far south to make their claim, because there were no such thing as regional claims. Remember this in 1966, that was 7 years after statehood. And so the provision in the Statehood Act that allowed the state to take 103 million acres was in process, right? The state was beginning to make those 103 million acre selections, and they were 7 years into it by the time we got involved. And Ituk and them, they decided to make the parallel their claim. And then they said, oh, well, Willie will take care of his area. Well, at that point, I didn't know anything, right? But that research paper I did for Judge Rabinowitz actually gave me the tools I needed and the understanding of where things were and how they came to be in 1966. I mean, I had a chance to go way back and look at the Indian Treaty era. I had a chance to look at the Treaty of Session. I had a chance to look at the Organic Acts. I had a chance to look at the Allotment Acts. I had a chance to look at the Missions Act of 1900. I had a chance to look at the Indian Citizenship Act of 1924. I had a chance to read the Indian Reorganization Act that allowed us to form our tribes. I took a look at the Statehood Act, and I took a look at how the compensatory system that had been in place. And I realized at that moment that they had never extinguished our underlying title, even all the way through the Statehood Act. That means we still had what's called Aboriginal title. But the realization that I had that made me very, very anxious was the fact that when the state made a selection, say like they did at Prudhoe, say they took 100,000 acres, they chose it, They brought it to the secretary through the BLM and he signed it. That was an extinguishment. You'd never get that land back. And so, but the reality was that the country was had been in the business of taking Indian lands. And so the idea of us actually able to get land was really pie in the sky. I mean, it had never happened, you know? And so that was the big challenge. But what we started doing was like, if you were a homesteader, like out here at O'Malley or all these people around here who had homesteads around Anchorage, if the state overselected on their homestead, they had a provision. They could protest the state selection to protect their rights, you know? But there was no such provision for natives. There was not even any hearings, you know, built into the doggone Statehood Act. So the Statehood Act was basically a license to steal, so to speak, you know, without compensation, right? And so to me, it was pretty damn clear that we had to stop the state selections in order to protect our rights. And that's really what began to occur, starting with Arctic Slope in January of 66. And then we did it in the summer of 66. And then we had the AFN convention in the fall, thanks to Emil's invitation. And then by within a matter of a year or two, about 1.5 times of Alaska was being, you know, selected by Native people. And that became the great fight, was because the Secretary of Interior recognized that maybe he had an obligation as trustee of Indian lands, maybe to protect us. And so he wouldn't process the state selections. And that became sort of the flashpoint in our battle, really.
So I do have something to add to that, or something to maybe help carry that conversation on a little bit more. You know, we talked a little bit about the ownership of Alaska, and we kind of jumped right into the land claims and listening to Nixon. But something that I want to know, these are the sort of things between the lines. How did the Clinken and Haida lands settlement or original legal issues affect what you guys did? Because they already had some sort of negotiations, correct?
yeah, they took the only route that was available to them in their era. And that route was the Court of Claims. And it wasn't an easy route because you had to have a lawyer or somebody to help you get a resolution through the Congress that would authorize the tribe to sue the United States. And of course, once you did that, then the tribe had to have the money to hire a lawyer and an anthropologist. and the lawyer's job was to determine whether or not there had been an illegal taking and the time of the taking. And usually it's like 50 or 75 or maybe 100 years before, right? And the anthropologist's job was to determine the extent of use and occupancy, which, in other words, how much land did the tribe utilize to survive, right? And that usually was in the millions of acres, right? And so they would if they proved there was an illegal taking, which there was in the case of the Tongass forests that were taken from them by the United States government, they multiplied the 16 million acres or so times the value at the time of the taking, which was pennies, right? And so all they got was $7.5 million, and not an acre of land. And so that was really impactful. When I was doing my little research, I thought, holy smokes, that whole system is stacked against the Native people. And so in my mind, I was just a kid at the time, but I thought to myself, you know, we have to have something new, something that's more equitable, right? Oh, yeah. And that's what we went after, something different.
Definitely. Man, every time I listen to you guys speak, I get fired up like, all right, let's do this. But now we're looking back, this is history. This is what had happened. And at that time, I imagine it was a challenge. What sort of reaction were you guys getting from the public or the, I mean, when you guys went to DC, I imagine both you and Oliver went to DC to go and fight this stuff. What was it like?
Well, if I may, you know, as we went along, the more we found out about this knowledge, the more we wanted to do. So I heard this guy that was writing a land claims bill, ANCSA, just a lawyer that had been hired. He was a general counsel to a chairman of a committee. So he wrote down all the things that the chairman wanted. I wanted that lawyer because he had some knowledge of the things we didn't know anything about. So I went back and I said, I tell you what, I'll set you in office. I'll give you some money. And you set up your shop. But I want to be one of your first clients. Because you know something about land claims. You know something about what goes on in a lawyer's mind, and what Congress is like. And he was the general counsel to the Interior Department, the Interior Committee. So when he came out and set up his law offices, I was one of his big clients. Because I'd already given him and signed over a bunch of money. These are for your law books. This is for your law offices. For your library. So, as we went along, we learned things. And became knowledgeable. Then we started hiring people. And the guy's name was Bill Van Ness. He was the general counsel to the Interior Committee. Because he wrote the land claims bill. And you know how when you're having conversations and having good times and having a few drinks, you accuse each other of a few. To accuse him about, you mucked us over. You sold us out. And I would think that, you know, he felt shame. His whole law firm became the land claims type lawyer. And then I became very close friends with the chairman of the committee through this lawyer. There was a lot to learn. There was still a lot more to learn about how to claim land, how to go about them. And that's how you made friends. Learn to negotiate with the guy one-on-one, with the guy that's going to sponsor a bill.
Tavra? Oliver?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wanted to add a little bit more to Oliver. You asked, you know, what was this like? What was this like? It was terrible. I mean, we were fighting the whole world. First of all, Secretary Udall, our hero, you had to understand the importance of the what's so-called land freeze, where the secretary decided that maybe he needed to try to protect, as trustee, native lands, because Congress had never ever defined which lands were ours. But if you use the standard that was in the Court of Claims, that is the extent of use and occupancy, there was not an acre of land in Alaska that wasn't controlled by some group in historical times. And of course, sometimes those boundaries shifted, but people fought hard to control their space because it meant the survival of their people, right? And so that land freeze became a flashpoint, and it, especially so in 1968 when ARCO found Prudhoe Bay. All of a sudden, this was big time politics, you know, I mean, the stakes all of a sudden grew dramatically. And I just remember, when Mike Wallace from 60 Minutes came to Alaska, he thought he was going to do a big oil story back in 69. When he got up here, he realized the story was, well, who owns it? Whose land is that? Right. And of course, at that point, we needed national exposure, because you can't go after national congressional legislation without having the public behind you on something as massive as what came out. So we really needed that national exposure. And Mike Wallace did a great job, I thought, of telling our story. Of course, he gave both sides, the state's anti-native claims side but our side. So that was important. But Secretary Udall deserves a statue, in my opinion. He was one of the most hated guys by the non-native community, but he was a hero to us. But without that land freeze, they were going to run over us. You know, if they had gotten the pipeline without resolving the question of native claims, we would still be right now twiddling our thumbs with no regional corporations, no village corporations. We'd be sitting waiting for a decision from the Court of Claims, which would include absolutely no land whatsoever. You know, so that to me is the reality of what we were facing back then. But the good news is, you know, the Native people stuck together. And Emo mentioned that. It was not easy. It absolutely was not easy, because you had a whole conglomeration of Natives, with many different interests, different sized groups, different ways of life, different languages, and oftentimes had been historical enemies, right? So we had to work hard to keep that unity, because that in the end, that was really what delivered for us. But on the other side, if the state was not a player and wasn't moving forward with some ideas of their own, if they had, in fact, Wally Hickel's initial thing was to, dig in, say, wait a minute, Congress, you said we could have this land, it's ours, the hell with those natives. Well, Uncle Wally, good for him, was pragmatic, he was a deal maker. And in the end, it served us well. Because, and most Alaskans, I don't think, realize this, that he was actually the first public official to support 40 million acres. The first. Even our hero, Secretary Udall, through his department, I think they're only willing to give 7 to 10 million. So, 44 million acres in the context of Alaska isn't a lot. But in the context of Native American settlements, it's pretty sizable. We almost have as much land as all the American Indians put together, and we still hear moaning and groaning. Of course we moaned and groaned. In fact, when you talk about what was it like that night when Joe spoke, there was quite a few who spoke. Emil spoke, I spoke, Don Wright spoke, others spoke. But, after 5 years of struggle, just hanging on, you'd think that there would have been celebration. But there wasn't. It was, we knew what we were giving up, right? We knew what we were giving up, and we had an uncertain future, because what the hell did we know about business, right? So, I mean, I think the remarkable story is that people just didn't sit back and cry about it all. They said, well, what the heck, let's get this thing together and let's see what we can do with it. And then that's what people have done. And I think that's remarkable.
Willie, you bring up an excellent point that we had, I mean, in many ways, the Alaska Natives with ANCSA and the announcement of what Nixon said out loud was a better deal than any Law 48 Natives ever received in some ways, because we won land, title to land. However, we lost certain rights until Anelka. But what I wanted to bring up is that, you know, we wouldn't even have gotten to that point if it wasn't for the relationships that were built right around that time. And we heard email say, yeah, well, my tribe was fighting with Unalakleet. I could hear my grandfather talking about them killing each other. And I know that because we are so diverse in Alaska. But you guys had maybe all gone to Mount Edgecombe or Chamawa or what have you. I know those relationships were integral. And it wasn't always good. It wasn't always fun. It wasn't always great. But you guys came together during a time where we needed to come together. Now, so there's a couple of questions I want to ask you guys. Is it what were those relationships like with people that you knew were warring tribes that you didn't like or you fought? Maybe you might have gotten a fight with them at Mount Edgecombe. And then what was it like trying to build relationships with people at DC? And how did you have to? Because you know that it's when you fight someone at Mount Edgecombe, that's going to be something. But when you fight with them at DC, that's going to be a do or die of a bill, right? So I want to hear a little bit more about your guys' relationships in-state and out-of-state.
We saw those things coming. I mean, like, John Sackett and I were roommates for 3 years. He was Doyon. I was Arctic Slope. Shit. We warred together. Our grandfathers, they hated each other. They didn't even like to get near each other. But we knew sometimes that you got to become friends. And it wasn't easy. Nothing in life during that time was easy. Because we didn't know how. We experienced it before. I mean, there were rough times. But we made it work. I mean, we sat and talked around, you know, have a couple of beers in the evenings about, teased each other about our Eskimo-Indian wars and some of the stories that we'd heard. But we found a way when we had to get together. And we often talked about those things. And it wasn't easy sometimes. But somehow, you say, oh, buddy, we got to sit down and talk. And we managed. And especially, you know, like our boundaries. They went up here, they went down over there. I mean, it's just like a seesaw. I mean, we found ways.
Oliver, if I may, there's a couple of questions I want to ask you and Willie. One, I want to know a little bit more about how relationships were in DC for you guys. And then two, how the idea of corporations came about.
Well, relations among each other it's just natural of coming together and talking and learning about each other and the things and the customs that we had that were so different. We made fun of each other. We had good times. But corporations were really somehow Congress was looking for ways to not have reservations. They were done with reservations. They didn't like reservation systems. So they were looking for a way economically to put something together. And that's how the idea of the corporations came. Because it really came from Congress. And and there were people in Congress that would just as soon sell you out. Let the devil have you.
I think Willie wanted to say something about corporations.
Yes,
sir.
If you can see this little thing here, if I can get it up big enough for, can you see it? Proposal for settlement of the Alaska Native land claims, a report of the Governor's Task Force on Native land claims, January 10th through 18th, 1968, to the Honorable Walter J. Hickel, Governor. And I want you to see who signed the doggone thing. See where? Willie Hensley, Chairman. For you historians, I mean, almost nobody knows this official report that actually was, the reason it's so small, it's because it was designed to fit in the House of Representatives daily log in Juneau. And let me give you the political context of where we were at this particular time. Wally Hickel was the first one to have to face the issue of Native regional claims that resulted in that land freeze. And as you might recall, Alaska had a little population of just over 200,000 people, had no significant industries, was a high cost state to do anything. We had a little bit of oil production in Kenai. Otherwise, Egan was running a failing state in the 1960s. When I got there in 67, our state budget was only $100 million. And he had to work hard to do that. And we didn't have any money to spend on capital improvements. We had to vote on statewide on bonds. Well, the state was supposed to get 90% of all the revenue from federal lands. Well, when we started those regional claims, it kind of froze the revenue that was coming to the state from that source. And back then, you know, $1 million could build a gigantic building. So $1 million was a lot of money. We're causing the state to lose money. Well, so Wally, to protect the state, he was going to run over us politically or legally, right, to do his job. Well, our job was to hang in there and try to protect our claims. Well, the problem was, as Emil noted earlier, we had nothing. We had no money. We had, you know, we had members who had no money to pay a membership fee. We had to have contracts for Emil from AFN to just to have him in office. We couldn't even get together to come up with a position, for God's sake. You know, we had no time. I mean, you know, if we had like a year to contemplate stuff or to plan and, you know, think about this, that or not, we didn't have that time. I mean, once I found that oil, it was, you know, crazier than heck. The pressure was on. And so, the way we got it out, like I said earlier, if the state wasn't playing ball, there's no bill. If the natives were divided, there's no bill, because the system won't work back there. People won't know what to do back in D.C., especially our delegation. So it was absolutely critical that we get the state on board. And the way we did that was by working with WALI to form this task force. They put the entire AFN board on it. The board voted to select a task force, a land claims task force, which I chaired. Sackett was on it. John Borbidge was on it. We had somebody from Arctic Slope. I think Hugh Nichols was on it. Maybe Eben may have come some of the time. Cecil Barnes was on it from Chugach. We tried to spread it out, and we only had like a week or so because there were going to be Senate hearings. And so let me give you the language as to how this is how we got up with the 40 million acres. We proposed 40 million acres. That was our first thing. 40 million grant of 40 million acres of land in fee. Now that's highly unusual, highly unusual. Private property, not trust land, right? Okay, a 10% royalty interest in Outer Continental Shelf, a 5% royalty on from the state. Now that was new. The state was making a concession. In the end, the state paid for half the $1 billion, right? Okay, and then a license to use the surface of lands for hunting and fishing purposes. And in the end, here's what we said. The objective of the task force is to avoid courts and litigation, simplify the administrative process, accomplish this early, let's not wait 100 years like the Court of Claims, a grant of present property interests, avoidance of state and federal control. And that was critical because Emil mentioned Joe Fitzgerald. This is Joe Fitzgerald's 6-pound, you know, 400-page document. But in reality, Joe Fitzgerald, under contract to Senator Jackson, who was chairman of the committee, basically his idea was to use this a proposed settlement to essentially eliminate the cultures, because they saw the villages as racial enclaves. And while they came up with one good thing, they came up with the biggest dollar amount, which is $1 billion. What his administrative process would have been: presidential appointed group to a commission, all natives in Alaska would have been enrolled as shareholders, and in 10 years it was going to be public. There was absolutely going to be no native entity, right? Under Senator Jackson's contractor, right? The first study in 100 years, okay? So that was what we faced on that side. Well, the Secretary of Interior, his job, he was going to control it through a commission. It'd be trust land. You know, in his big number, you know what his big number was? $180 million. Because he said, well, how much was the best Indian settlement? They figured, well, it was the Senecas at $3,000 per person for the building of the Kenzua Dam. Well, so even our best hero was recommending less than $200 million. You see, we had to go from zilcho to 40 million. We had to go from zilcho to a billion, right? And so that took a lot of effort. And the reason it was done is because we hung together in spite of our differences, right? And the last one was utilizing modern corporate forms for engaging in business enterprise by native groups. That's where it came from, was that task force that nobody remembers. Those ideas actually followed Wally Hickle when he became Secretary of Interior, right? So he already had supported the 40 million acres. And so some of those ideas survived the recommendation to the state, but to me, the important part is that that report changed the tone in Alaska. Because I was in the legislature, I knew what was going on. The legislature actually passed a bill committing $25 million to a settlement, but it was contingent on lifting the freeze, which of course didn't happen, but it was there. It was a good intent. And also Bob Atwood, the Anchorage Times, who had been fighting native claims since the 40s, by God, he thought it was, you know, the recommendations were good. So that work of that task force, Emil was on it, you know, was very, very critical. Because it kept the state moving forward. If we had come out and said, we want 200 reservations, you know, the state would have gone nuts. They would not be on board. And so, you know, when you're engaged in negotiations, I mean, you know, you can't get everything you want, especially if you're a minority, because you're basically a supplicant on your hands and knees. And when the door is shut back in D.C., you're outside and they're inside cutting the deal, right? So you do the best you can.
So Willie, I'm getting a slew of questions here, and I'm getting text messages too. There's a lot of engagement of what you guys are talking about. And honestly, I feel guilty that I feel like I should have gave you guys a 4-hour session to talk, because you guys are so full of knowledge, and you guys are the experts in the field. How many people are left from our region that were there fighting for this? Not a whole lot, and you guys were there. So some of the questions, I'm just going to kind of field a little bit of the questions and summarize them in some ways. Some people are asking about what were the most controversial parts of ANCSA that either you guys were for or against, or a lot of people want to know about Eduk, because we know Eduk was a brilliant man. But he struggled in some ways, but he was very radical and let his presence be known. And people are still talking about him. So there's Eduk. And then people want to know about Senator Ted Stevens. Was he our friend? Was he our foe? I know Oliver has some stories about Stevens and how he was able to sway him to get him to go our way. Because at first he might not have been so friendly. So there's Stevens, Eduk, and then now, is there, you know, from what you guys went through back then, this is the third question. Now we're in a pandemic. There's a disconnection, maybe because we're all having to be isolated. Do you think that original Spanish flu, and a lot of people died, had given us strength or weakened us to be able to handle ANCSA, or it took away from our power and our strength to handle it? So there's those three questions. Eduk, Senator Stevens, Spanish flu. We have only 20 minutes left, so take those questions as you will. Whichever questions you guys want to go for first, whatever's most meaningful, I'll let you guys go.
Avilan, Lukagin.
Huh?
Okay. Lukagin.
Oh. Eduk was a fun guy. He was brilliant. Crazy. He was a lot of fun because he'll make you talk forever just to defend what you've come up with or what you think might work. Ted Stevens, hell, he was Arctic Slope's friend. We didn't have a relationship with Ted Stevens when the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act past. And we said to Joe, our chairman, he said, Chair, you can't have enemies back there, especially like Ted Stevens, because he was our senior senator. You couldn't get anything passed without him. So he said, find a way to be able to talk to him. So I just picked up the phone right at his desk and called his office and asked for Ann Stevens, Ted's wife. He loved
I think we might have lost Oliver's connection.
Okay.
Oliver, go ahead.
Oliver, are you there? Let me call up Martina and see what's going on.
It might be their internet, and you might need to log back on. I don't know.
Yeah, let me. I'm going to put myself on mute. Willie, if you would like to talk a little bit more about E2.
Okay.
And Ted Stevens,
Okay. I know there's an interest in many of the leaders who may not be well known, and some of the key players.
Yes.
In office, maybe I can talk a little bit about them until Oliver comes back. On the local level, the key political players at the state level were Governor Hickel initially, and then later on Governor Egan came back, and he came back at a very, very key time. But Hickel beat Egan in the 66 election by a small margin, in part by appealing to Native voters, actually. Bartlett died. So when Hickel was governor, he appointed Ted Stevens, who I served with in the House. And Stevens was knowledgeable because, you know, he was a lawyer. He'd been in the Interior Department as a young lawyer during a statehood fight. So he was not new to Indian issues, per se. Greening was in office. And let me tell you, Greening was a very brilliant man. He'd been territorial governor. He was a medical doctor, Harvard graduate. He's been a diplomat. He was an author. He'd been governor of the territory under Franklin Roosevelt. And he also was a United States Senator. But, you know, I had a conflict with him right off the bat, just as a student, really, when I challenged some comments he made in the press when I was doing my research on my land claims paper. He said basically something like, well, what we need to do is pay off the natives and get on with the development of this land. That really ticked me off at first. And then because I thought he was throwing cold water on whatever legitimate claims we might have. And of course, I didn't know his history at that point in time. He and I met because he asked to meet with me. So we had our little conversation, and he blamed the Interior Department for not doing anything. But I said, well, Senator, under our system, the secretary can't solve the problem. It's a congressional responsibility. And you're the one that set up this conflict because as senator, you authorized, you know, you lobbied for the Statehood Act, and it's trying to take our land without compensation. So we went our separate ways. And, you know, Greening did not believe, I don't think, in anything that related to Indian tribes having legal, you know, relationship with the federal government. I don't think he believed anything like the Bureau of Indian Affairs. You know, I don't think he would have supported indigenous controlled even corporations. And so I think we're darn lucky that we supported Mike Gravel and he won. And he helped deliver because he was in the majority with Senator Jackson. Stevens was an appointee of Hickel, and initially we were quite leery of him because basically, you know, he had run before and lost. And so Hickel gave him new life politically, But at that point, we were fighting tooth and tong to try to keep the land freeze, because without the land freeze, we were going to get run over. They're, if they got that pipeline, they'd forget about us. As it turns out, you know, Stevens played a very key role, because he was the same party of the president, right? And he helped get the president on board. And then there was Nick Begich, who was he was my roommate in Juneau when we were in the legislature. And he also helped deliver on the House side. Those are the politicians over there. And then on the Native side, I'm going to read you some names of people who are volunteering, no pay, taking their time. People like Emo, John Borbridge, Flory Lekanoff from the Aleut, Jerome Trigg from Nome, Miles Brandon, who is Inupiaq but lived in the Bristol Bay area, Cecil Barnes, who is the father of Chugach, Don Wright, who was our president at the time, Sam Keto, George Miller from Kenai, Byron Malott, Roy Ewan from the interior of Otna, Al Kessler. Al deserves more recognition because he was actually there before many of us were. You know, he made a visit to see Secretary Udall before there was even an AFN. Roy Ewan, Gerald Ivey, Eben Hobson, Fred Bismarck, Philip Guy, long gone, George Undola, Flora Thiel from the Kenai area. So those are some of the people. Alice Brown, there's others like that who are long gone, who took the time to, Larry Oskolkoff, Margaret Nick, Don Watson from the Beth, from here, but he had a brother in Bethel, Tim Wallace, Harry Carter, you know, all those people gave their time and effort to, and their minds to try to come up with solutions to this really, really complex problem.
Man, you have so much detailed information, and I want to make sure that we're hitting everybody's questions, comments, concerns. So if you guys have any questions, please go to the chat. I've been fielding them as I can and throwing them out to our experts time allows. The one question that, so there's something that that people are wanting to know in terms of our pandemic that we're in now.
Yeah.
I see
that question, Patuk. You know, we were in our own pandemic, actually, at the time. You know, we're dying of tuberculosis.
Yes.
You know, yes. I mean, I have notes here from Chills and Fevers, Dr. Fortine's big book on the diseases that Native people had encountered going back to the 1830s, smallpox epidemic 1835 to 1840, maybe wiping out a third of the population in southern part of Alaska. Then there was diphtheria, whooping cough, gonorrhea, typhoid, tuberculosis, just was wiping us out then. So, you know, those diseases were not new to us. We just suffered through them. I mean, almost all of us were impacted by TB. But I think, you know, what in my mind, I mean, what really shaped the people's dedication back then who were involved was that we were all struggling through life, right? We had to work hard. You know, we were hungry, we were cold. We had to run, walk, lift, push, you know, we had to chop, we had to get out there in the cold weather to make a livelihood. And I think people knew all that, and they wanted their children and grandchildren to have something better, right? Something, their life was a little easier. And for all those who are shooting arrows at the settlement, I mean, we didn't even remotely think about a corporation in the beginning. That was not the idea. The idea was to get that land so that our people can continue their existence as special people of the earth, right? Because they were all tied to that land after 10,000 years. But, you know, like I said, you know, you don't control the process as a minority. You're basically on hands and knees working as hard as you could to get something, you know? And thank God the stars lined up that we did get something. not what we should have gotten. We should have got, we could have gotten more, actually. I think if the non-native community had been a little bit more open-minded, I mean, I could read you some quotes from some. Oh, right here, I got it right here. You want to hear this one?
Yes.
This is from my neighbor.
We do.
This is my neighbor, and you know, our region is big into mining, and this guy was head of the Miners Association. He says, if my understanding of this purchase agreement is correct, then these claims which we are discussing today should rightfully be directed to the Russian government. I submit to you that neither the United States, the state of Alaska, nor any of us here gathered as individuals owe the natives 1 acre of ground or 1 cent of the taxpayers' money. That was my neighbor, George Morlang. And so you talk about hot politics. I mean, you think anti-masking and vaccine is hot. You should have been around back then when we were battling over who owned Alaska. It was a struggle, but you know, and Emil didn't mention it, but even the Chamber of Commerce were mocking natives, because Don Dickey, who ran the chamber, when they had a convention, he was running around with a cowboy hat with an arrow running through it. That was his view about, you know, the native claims, right? And so now all these business entities, you think they were our last great buddy, but in reality, in the beginning, they were fighting us tooth and tongue, including the Alaska Territorial Sportsmen, the timber industry, we were fighting everybody. But if even people like Bob Atwood, who ran the biggest newspaper, he had been anti-native land since the 40s, when the secretary had power to create reservations in Alaska. I mean, he and, Greening was a left winger. Robert was a right winger. But when it came to claims, they were sort of like one. They were in agreement. I think Greening went ape when he heard about the creation of the reserve up there at Venati. He just went ape. And I think that's probably what turned him against the idea of natives owning any land. That's kind of a little bit of the story there.
Matt, and I feel real bad every time I interrupt you, because I don't want to be that.
That's okay. Person. That's your job.
And I'm learning from you always with the history, and I'm learning even how to become a moderator even a little bit better. So don't be offended if I do interrupt you, because I would have got spanked if I was at home in Barrow right now. My dad would have probably. Don't interrupt. Anyways, I know that there have been, we are running out of time. We got about 5 minutes. I see some questions in the chat. I've been told that we can go up to 3:15. So that's like the longest we can go. There are some other questions in the chat.
Now, this is Karen. I'm going to just interrupt with a question that has been asked and sort of summarize it for Oliver. That at the time of land claims, the Arctic Slope Native Association was not particularly on board because of the acreage and the claim that, you know, the Inupiaq never gave Russia permission to even sell their part of Alaska to the United States. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what was going on with that issue at the time and how you guys worked through all that and finally decided to sign on to the Settlement Act.
Can you guys hear us okay?
Yeah.
Maybe you could turn your video on too. It might work now.
Hey, Dad, you're good. You can answer the question.
What's that?
You can answer the question. I can hear you.
God. Question was twofold.
Well, the question was about the ASNA not wanting to sign on to the ANSCA and all that fight over the acreage and the legality of it.
So, you know, ASRC is not with AFN, and then you guys didn't want
to.
Oh, sorry.
our belief was that 40 million wasn't enough. We wanted a lot more land, like 60 million acres rather than 40 million acres. And as simple as that.
Might actually have to turn off.
Yeah, we always thought that you sell the land. Believe in that.
Dobra?
No.
Yeah.
Maybe I could help clarify that point. That was one of the big internal. Like I said, if the natives were divided, we were screwed. That was one of the big issues. Another issue, Arctic Slope, one of the problems was we had an AFN that had no, it was a volunteer group, big tent. So we had urban native groups like Fairbanks Native Association. We had, you know, urban groups like our host, Cook Inlet. We had tribes like Tlingit Haida. We had Tanana Chiefs, big group. We had AVCP, big group. We had village, you know, village tribes with the same vote as I did. I had 11 villages, they had one. Well, anyway, what we tried to do was deal with every major issue that was going to divide us and complicate our ability to get through Washington. And in the case of Arctic Slope, like the further north you go in Alaska, the more spread out the people are out of necessity, because that's where the animal life was. You could not have big towns except places like Point Hope, where they had hundreds of people because they had the protein. Well, so under the Settlement Act, it was going to be the land was going to be divided, you know, based on the enrollment. Well, that meant that Arctic Slope was going to get small land, even though they used a lot of land. So we came up with that land loss formula that allowed them to get more. That's how we resolved that issue. One of the other issues was 7i. Well, it wasn't exactly something that I think we dreamt up. I think what I saw was that Secretary Udall being questioned by Senator Hansen from out west. The senator says, Secretary, what about a village if it ends up finding 10 million barrels of oil over here, and then down along the river 3 or 4 or 10 miles was another village that has nothing? What are you going to do about that? The secretary said, oh, we've thought about that. He said, you know, we came up with this idea of 50-50, you know, sharing. Well, somehow that ended up becoming 70-30, you know, and ended up in the act. But in a way, back then, we didn't know who was going to have what, you know. And so if you want 70% of what I got, I don't have anything. So yeah, you can have 70%. But in the end, that, you know, we're living with that. And as a consequence, I know the Arctic Slope has paid millions and millions in 7i. And Nana, we've paid about $1.5 billion. The other regional corporations and the villages. So, I mean, you know, I think it's something that needs to be looked at, you know, for the developer region in the future, but because I think it's somewhat unfair.
Now, I just want to open it up a little bit more to anybody else that might have had questions to our esteemed elders, Oliver and Willie. I think what we're going to try to do is get Oliver on a phone line to make sure that the connection is solid. But if anybody has any questions for Willie in regards to all of this, please do not hesitate to ask either in the chat. I don't know if they could ask Karen. Can they ask directly?
Who can ask directly? The people in the audience?
Yeah.
If they raise their hand, I can give them voice.
Okay. Privileges. If anybody has a question directly for Willie while we get Oliver set up with the dial-in number.
May I make one point?
Yeah, go ahead.
Some people think that this is an oil bill. Well, actually, the oil industry, you know, we were kind of holding them hostage in a way because of the land freeze. We wouldn't let them get there right away until we got our problem solved, right? But we had to play that very careful because the whole nation wanted that oil, you know? And if we didn't play our cards right, we were always concerned that since we didn't know all about Washington, D.C., we thought, well, maybe they could just, the president could just, or even the Secretary of Interior could just issue an executive order saying, by gosh, we want that pipeline, we need it, kaboom, here's the right of way, and then we're going to be dead in the water, right? But thankfully that didn't happen, but we always were concerned about that, because if they got the oil pipeline and the oil, like I say, we're going to be put in the backwater, and there would still be no settlement, in my opinion. But Ed Patton, who was head of the consortium of oil companies that had the lease at Prudhoe Bay, he realized, and they had some good advice from people like Hugh Gallagher, who was in a wheelchair, used to be at work for Senator Bartlett, who was lobbying for BP, and others who encouraged them to support the passage of a bill. Because for them, it would mean security of their lease and also a right-of-way. And so when Ed Patton backed the land settlement bill, It made it hell of a lot easier for the Chamber of Commerce and all those other business people that had been fighting us to get on board, right? So that's one point I wanted to make.
We just had some questions that hit the chat. The loss of Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights, that's a big issue. Why was this necessary? I mean, that switched up during ANILCA. But that, I mean, I don't know if we're just focusing on ANCSA and not everything else that happened after that. That's one thing. We have a couple more questions after that. I don't know if you guys wanted to.
I think we have Oliver back by phone. So I have to ask to unmute.
Yeah, maybe if you guys want to discuss Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights in the first Act and why we had to do ANILCA, or what was the maybe that might have been a reason why people were against ANCSA in the first place, extinguishing our subsistence rights on these certain lands. Would you guys like to talk a little bit about that?
Patrick, do you remember what are the on the phone, how they unmute themselves? Do you remember what you push?
It's like star. Oh, shoot.
Let me look. Star 9 or something like that.
Let's look on trusty Google.
You should be able to just talk.
Can you hear us okay?
Yes. I'm going to mute myself because there's an echo.
Yeah, go ahead, Oliver. Yeah, there's an echo, I think, because of your computer being on.
Turn the connection on the computer off, and then just do the phone one. That's it.
Oh, it's star 6. Thank you, Freya. Or just turn down your computer volume, Martina. That will get rid of the echo. I thought by having you on mute it would, but it doesn't. So we have a couple of questions in the chat. I mean, people raising their hands. Um, What happened? Oh, I think Colleen, did you have your hand raised? And now it went away, but... Ron, in a way, had a question.
Yes, I want to thank everyone for participating in this series of, and particularly when you have these firsthand explanations of things that really are very parallel to a extensive bibliography that's being prepared on ANGCET 50. Those of us that are working on it have heard bits and pieces of what you folks have discussed very, very well and putting all of those pieces into a context that we previously have probably never heard of. So I want to extend my thanks to all of you for doing that. And some of you I know I've appealed to before, particularly to Imol and to folks who have very valuable papers. I really urge you to think about the donation of those papers into an archive where people who are interested will have access to them. During the process of putting this bibliography together, we realized that there are many significant folks who really haven't had any documentation. And I urge you to consider having those things placed into a depository wherever you think possible that would make them secure, that would be safe, and that would be useful for future generations to look at. Because if you probably gauge, there are lots of people who are curious. And without your contributions, we would never know these things. So thank you very much for your contributions.
Most definitely. Thank you so much, Willie and Oliver, for all of your hard work, not just your hard work, but your willingness to talk about it now. I mean, there were many of the leaders that were fighting back then that, one, aren't alive today. And then some of them, they may not even feel comfortable to talk. But you, Willie, and you, Oliver, are real leaders that are still willing to teach, and that is priceless. And I can never repay you for your willingness to join in on this. You, like I said in the beginning, you guys have been rock stars to me in my upbringing to give me hope and know that there's a lot that we can do as Native people, as leaders, young leaders, because you guys started out probably in your 20s. And you guys are still going, and I respect you guys at the utmost. So, Kuyinakpak, Ireruk, and Aviwan. You're on mute, Willie.
Ireruk, you're on mute. Kuyana, for the invitation, it was fun, I hope it's useful to your audience. In my opinion, we really do need historians in our native world. There are so many issues, not only current issues, but historical issues that should be looked at from an Indigenous perspective. Because, you know, all of my life I've collected books and maps and you name it. And it usually always was by somebody else looking at us, right? And then making their judgments. And quite often, of course, the Indigenous perspective is quite different about, you know, events that have transpired. And I'm thinking about issues like the Rampart Dam, or issues like the nuclear project of the atomic project Chariot, issues relating to medical testing of Indigenous peoples. I mean, there's just such a world of stuff out there that needs, research and writing about. And I really challenge the schools to do a better job than they're doing with the Alaska history requirement. Oftentimes they pick the most recent arrival from New York City to be the expert on Indigenous or Alaskan history. And we need to do more. I mean, it's just sad. Anyway, that's my parting comment.
Koyanuk, Willie, did we have Oliver? We lost the phone connection. I don't know if we can still get Zoom from them.
Oliver, are you there, Oliver? If all else fails, let me call up Martina real quick and ask her. and I, you know what? This is what I want to encourage our AHS board. We need to continue this discussion.
Yeah, that's
Martina. Hold on. Sorry.
So, Patrick, why don't you mute your...
Why don't you mute your...
Wait, Oliver, Martina, you guys there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Go
ahead.
I wanted to make sure we got some closing comments, and I did want to make the note that we need to continue this discussion. Just talking to you and really the past few days in preparation for this have encouraged me and inspired me to realize the importance to continue this discussion, that our history did not start when Russians came here or when America bought, United States bought Alaska. It's so much more than that. And we have a rich history. So, I want to hear what you have to say about your time and any closing comments that you have to say about your fight with INCSA and your successes.
Well, I think we have fought enough. I think we got to find ways to find common ground to help and assist each other. And fighting each other. I mean, there's a lot of the nice stuff that we went through amongst each other, amongst the 12 regions. Hey, and I want to thank you for knowledgeable person that you are about the land claims and what it's done for our region. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, everyone. I sure appreciate it. And I know that you've always encouraged me when I started doing my my cultural documentary work in our region. And you told me that this is what we've been trying to do for 30 years, to tell our own stories. And so I always think about that, and it encourages me every time that I work with others, to talk with others and capture our stories so that our younger generations may hear it. And I am so appreciative of you, Willie, even to be willing to share your time, both of you guys, to share with our AHS group and then anyone else that has registered for the conference. So thank you all that who was participating. I look forward to many more sessions like this in the future. Willie, is there anything you wanted to add?
Really appreciate the audience and all those really great questions. I know it's something that you all don't think about every day, but it's something that people like Oliver and myself kind of live through. And I think the pleasure was in the success of you know, trying to improve conditions for people. And like I said, it's, you know, it's nothing that's cast in stone. You know, we've managed to make amendments to the act to improve it. But in reality, it's up to people like you, Patuk, and other young people who understand the connection between the people and that land and how we might be able to keep it long into the future, you know, because, you know, if you have something of value, there's somebody out there going to try to get it, you know. So thank you.
So true.
Okay, I want to say Koyanakpak, and as you could tell, Willie, you said there's lots of great questions in the chat, and so I'm thinking we need to have another discussion like this to answer all those questions. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to get through all those questions.
No, you need to take my class. Yes. That's what you got to do. Take my...
That's what my dad told me to do. I got to
mark it.
Yes.
My dad sucked me and said, take Willie's class. You're going to learn so much. Yes. And every time I talk to him, I learn a lot. So yes, Willie, your class is with UAA, right? It's like a 2-day thing.
Yeah. Or so it's a 3-weekender.
Oh, three weekends.
Yeah, it's a graduate class, but I take undergraduates if I give them a waiver. But anyway, it's not strictly about land claims. It's actually, it includes a lot more.
We should promote that on our social media, guys. AHS.
Willie, what's the name of the class?
It's called Alaska Policy Frontiers.
Okay.
And it's in the College of Business and Public Policy. Okay. But actually, Oliver has helped me with a short course I've done, and I'm going to do it next semester. It's called Traditional Values in the Modern Native Corporation.
Oh, good.
And the inspiration of that was Oliver and their experience in getting ASRC going back in the early days when a lot of the leaders were the ones with respect, the hunters, right? The whale hunters. And they had to somehow figure a way through between the corporate world and the traditional world. And so we have, you know, that sort of discussion from other communities and even villages and sometimes tribes. So I think it's a lot of fun.
Great. And is that a distance? Can people get into that course through a distance?
Actually, last semester, my classes were Zoom. This semester, it's primarily in person, but I think next time it's going to be a choice. You could be either come in person or take it online.
Okay, great. And this morning, I wanted to mention, well, I don't know if Sam Quito is still on, or how he would feel about mentioning that he's working on a book. So hopefully we will be able to see that someday soon about his experiences. So... I know we've run way over, and I said we could go for hours more. So the next session is supposed to start at 3:30. So come back when you can. Right now, I'll end this session, and we'll take a little break.
Yeah, and we'll share information about your class.